Blog Talk Radio.
This is Paula Thompson, and you're listening to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. And with me is my dear friend and co-host, Crystalline Beek Larson. Hi, Crystalline.
Hi.
So good to have you this morning, but we miss our brother Andre. He's not with us this morning. He's got other meetings, I guess, so he'll be back with us next week. But Crystalline and I wanted to do something in honor of our great big election that's coming up in a couple of days. And a presidential election and all the other things that go with that, electing congressmen. And so, you know, I recently posted on Facebook the little baby who broke down in tears because she couldn't bear to hear one more election. She literally, so sincerely, just broke down in tears because she couldn't bear to hear one more election.
Did I send you that email by any chance?
No, I don't know. Joanne told me about it. My associate, Joanne, that works with me, told me about it, and we both just laughed because, you know, we can relate.
I thought that was so funny.
So anyway, in honor of that, we thought we would do something. We would read something, a paper, one of the shortest papers in the Urantia book. Crystalline assures me it is the shortest paper in the Urantia book, and we want to get through it. Some of our listeners may not know exactly what all the Urantia book contains. I know many of you do, but paper 71 is called Development of the State, and it's presented to us, to our world, to the humans of our world, by Melchizedek, who reigns in our local universe, and teaches, I should say, didn't reign, but he teaches in our local universe. He is a member of our local universe family. And I just noticed, interestingly enough, that the very next paper, paper 72, is Government on a Neighboring Planet. I found that kind of interesting, probably presented by the same Melchizedek who presents Government of the State. Crystalline and I have a couple of objectives by reading this paper. One, we want to get through it if we can. We'd love to take calls, but if you'll bear with us and let us get through this paper, then we'll take calls afterwards. The number is 646-716-8158, and we definitely want to hear from all of you, too. The other objective is to keep this decidedly apolitical. In other words, let's read this paper together and find the balance and the symmetry in it, because we know that this polarization that we experience in our world, the us and them mentality that you know, we've had Brian McLaren on, he spoke directly to that. His book is all about the us and them mentality and the antagonism that we get for them because they're not us. And it doesn't matter whether that's Democrat, Republican, Christian, Muslim, whatever division we can find in the world will accentuate that and make that all important. But the Urantia book doesn't do that. It doesn't accentuate divisions. It actually finds balance and symmetry when it brings both to the center. And I think as you listen to this paper and read it together with us, you'll see that symmetry in it. And, of course, Government on the Neighboring Planet also, the very next paper, paper 72, has it as well. There's a balance there, and certainly that's what I hope to achieve in my life is balance, not extremes, but balance. I want to be in the center. You know, and people love to say these days, I've lost my center. I feel off balance. And, you know, we know that God, the Heavenly Father, is in the center of all things. The Urantia book says he's at the center of all things and beings. And at the center is balance. And so when we're close to God, we're close to balance. And the closer to balance we get, the closer to God we are. So that's what we hope to achieve by reading this paper together. Not any partisan point of view, but an open point of view, a point of view that takes in both sides of the equation, those who have a point of view from either end and all in between. And so we want to openly embrace those points of view and see what we see in this paper, what wisdom it has to give us. So that's our objective. And if you'll bear with us, if you have questions, we are looking.
If you'd like to read along with us, you know, please do so. If you don't have a book in front of you, you can go to several different places online and read the book for free. You can go to the truthbook.com and look at the Urantia book search engine. You can also find it at the UrantiaBook.org and Urantia.org sites. Are there other places people can find it online, Paula?
Yeah, I like the one at UrantiaBook.org because you can easily find the papers. You have the three panels, and you can find paper 71 very easily. And that is urantiabook.org/ubsearch online. So,
and then just to as you're listening to us read, or as you're reading along with us, if you have some ideas about solutions to the kinds of modern problems that we find ourselves in as a planet, as a world, that's sort of kind of where we'd like to lead the discussion after we're finished with the reading. If you'd like to call in.
Yes. And also think about, as we read this, you know, what's it going to take to achieve some of these goals that they hold up for us? The Urantia book is very practical in that it gives us amazingly practical next steps from where we are that might lead us forward to a more unified world and to ultimately the brotherhood of man and sisterhood of woman. So without further ado, we can go ahead and start. Krislyn, do you want to begin?
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Urantia book, paper 71, The Development of the State. The state is a useful evolution of civilization. It represents society's net gain from the ravages and sufferings of war. Even statecraft is merely the accumulated technique for adjusting the competitive contest of force between the struggling tribes and nations. The modern state is the institution which survived in the long struggle for group power. Superior power eventually prevailed, and it produced a creature of fact, the state, together with the mortal myth of the absolute obligation of the citizen to live and die for the state. But the state is not of divine genesis. It was not even produced by volitionally intelligent human action. It is purely an evolutionary institution and was wholly automatic in origin.
That's an interesting comment, isn't it? It was purely evolutionary and wholly automatic. In other words, we would have developed a state no matter what. That was going to happen.
Why don't I read on to
through
section one, and then you start with section two?
Okay.
The embryonic state, section one. The state is a territorial social regulative organization, and the strongest, most efficient, and enduring state is composed of a single nation whose people have a common language, mores, and institutions. The early states were small and were all the result of conquest. They did not originate in voluntary associations. Many were founded by conquering nomads who would swoop down on peaceful herders or settled agriculturalists to overpower and enslave them. Such states resulting from conquest were, perforce, stratified. Classes were inevitable, and class struggles have ever been selective. The northern tribes of the American red man were never attained real statehood. They never progressed beyond a loose confederation of tribes, a very primitive form of state. Their nearest approach was the Iroquois Federation, but this group of six nations never quite functioned as a state, and failed to survive because of the absence of certain essentials to modern national life, such as 1. Acquirement and inheritance of private property. 2. Cities plus agriculture and industry. 3. Helpful domestic animals. 4. Practical family organization. These red men clung to the mother family and nephew inheritance. 5. Definite territory. 6. A strong executive head. 7. Enslavement of captives. They either adopted or massacred them. 8. Decisive conquests. The red men were too democratic. They had a good government, but it failed. Eventually, they would have evolved a state had they not prematurely encountered the more advanced civilization of the white man, who was pursuing the governmental methods of the Greeks and the Romans. The successful Roman state was based on 1. The father family, 2. Agriculture and the domestication of animals, 3. Condensation of population, cities, 4. Private property and land, 5. Slavery, classes of citizenship, 6. Conquest and reorganization of weak and backwards peoples, 7. Definite territory with roads, 8. Personal and strong rulers. The great weakness in Roman civilization and a factor in the ultimate collapse of the empire was the supposed liberal and advanced provision for the emancipation of the boy at 21 and the unconditional release of the girl so that she was at liberty to marry a man of her own choosing or to go abroad in the land to become immoral. The harm to society consisted not in these reforms themselves, but rather in the sudden and extensive manner of their adoption. The collapse of Rome indicates what may be expected when a state undergoes too rapid extension associated with the internal degeneration. The embryonic state was made possible by the decline of the blood bond in favor of the territorial, and such tribal federations were usually firmly cemented by conquest. While a sovereignty that transcends all minor struggles and group differences is the characteristic of the true state, still, many classes and castes persist in the later state organizations as remnants of the clans and tribes of former days. The later and larger territorial states had long and bitter struggle with these similar consanguineous clan groups, the tribal government proving a valuable transition from family to state authority. During later times, many clans grew out of trades and other industrial associations. Failure of the state integration results in retrogression to pre-state conditions of governmental techniques, such as the feudalism of the European Middle Ages. During these dark ages, the territorial state collapsed, and there was a reversion to the small castle groups. The reappearance of the clan and tribal stages of development. Similar semi-states even now exist in Asia and Africa, but not all of them are evolutionary reversions. Many are the embryonic nucleuses of states of the future.
So we get a little bit of a background on how the state evolves there from tribalism. And, you know, just touching again on some of the things that we've already talked about with our friends like Steve McIntosh, spiral dynamics comes to play here. We got to keep in mind that these papers were written in probably 1933 and 34. So that, you know, just keep that in mind as we go along.
And one of the questions that came up on the board was, I wonder why private property is such an important aspect of the development of a state. Having lived in a country that was more tribal in my earlier days, I know that one of the reasons is that when individuals don't own land, there can become many disputes about the use of particular lands by various members of the clan or family. And you can hardly imagine the number of disputes that come up, you know, when it isn't clear who owns what piece of land.
Yeah, and also the pride in ownership. That when somebody owns something, they take a great deal of pride in that, and they take good care of it. So that always occurred to me too. Why, you know, property and the ability to own property was important as well. Because
and what's going to be done with that work? I mean, what kind of work will be done on that land?
Right.
And you know, who allows what work to be, who makes the choices about what work or use or, in some cases, you know, abuse of that land would be allowed. So anyway,
shall we go on?
It was also interesting what they said about how they suddenly allowed the young men to be independent at 21 and for girls who weren't married to go out into the world on their own, and that happened so suddenly that it was a really disruptive sort of revolution in culture. So it sort of seems like it's subtly telling us that any kind of really drastic change, sudden change, can pretty much bring down the collapse of an empire.
Yeah, you know, and they give us a hint that that's about mores in some ways, because the women were at liberty to go abroad and become immoral. I thought that was a real interesting comment. So that's about the group mores, I think, and that, you know, we've seen that a bit in our own lifetimes. I've seen it, and I read a very important book, having two daughters, and I'm really glad I read the book. It was called Reviving Ophelia, and it was a woman psychologist who did a series of case studies, and she discovered that you know, girls were fine as long as they were in elementary school, but when they got to be 12, 13 in puberty, they were falling apart. And in all of these case studies, except for a couple of exceptions where the family structure was very well developed, they were just getting out in the world and getting angry and resentful and lashing out at their parents. And without fail, she came back to the same conclusion, and it was about the disintegration of the sexual mores. And I think, you know, and as I read this, I had to realize that my generation, the boomers or the hippies, had a lot to do with the disintegration of those sexual mores that protect women. And what she found was that those young girls were getting harassed out there, sexually harassed, and they weren't prepared for it. Nothing had prepared them for it. And they ended up resenting their parents because of it. Like, you didn't tell me what was going to happen out there. Mm. And so it's interesting. That's what I see. You know, I see a disintegration of mores, which, in my point of view, those same mores that, you know, that
were,
the sexual revolution
were sort of meant to liberate women.
Right. It was meant to liberate women, but it actually made them vulnerable, because those mores were there for a reason. They protected women, and without them, there was little left to protect women. So that's just a personal insight of mine. I mean, I can see in my own life how this is true, and how sometimes we really have to fight, you know, to protect that cultural riverbed, and that it's there for a reason. Sometimes we don't see the reason, but it's developed over many thousands of years, and it's there for a reason.
Well, shall we move on?
Yeah. Section 2, the evolution of representative government. Democracy, while an ideal, is a product of civilization, not of evolution. Go slowly. Select carefully, for the dangers of democracy are: 1. Glorification of mediocrity. 2. Choice of base and ignorant rulers. 3. Failure to recognize the basic facts of social evolution. 4. Danger of universal suffrage in the hands of uneducated and indolent majorities. 5. Slavery to public opinion. The majority is not always right. Public opinion, common opinion, has always delayed society. Nevertheless, it is valuable, for while retarding social evolution, it does preserve civilization. Education of public opinion is the only safe and true method of accelerating civilization. Force is only a temporary expedient, and cultural growth will increasingly accelerate as bullets give way to ballots. Public opinion, the mores, is the basic and elemental energy in social evolution and state development. But to be of state value, it must be nonviolent in expression. The measure of the advance of society is directly determined by the degree to which public opinion can control personal behavior and state regulation through nonviolent expression. The really civilized government had arrived when public opinion was clothed with the powers of personal franchise. Popular elections may not always decide things rightly, but they represent the right way even to do the wrong thing. Evolution does not at once produce superlative perfection, but rather comparative and advancing practical adjustment. There are 10 steps or stages to the evolution of a practical and efficient form of representative government, and these are: 1. Freedom of the person. Slavery, serfdom, and all forms of human bondage must disappear. 2. Freedom of the mind. Unless a free people are educated, taught to think intelligently and plan wisely, freedom usually does more harm than good. 3. The reign of law. Liberty can be enjoyed only when the will and whims of human rulers are replaced by legislative enactments in accordance with accepted fundamental law. 4. Freedom of speech. Representative government is unthinkable without freedom of all forms of expression for human aspirations and opinions. 5. Security of property. No government can long endure if it fails to provide for the right to enjoy personal property in some form. Man craves the right to use, control, bestow, sell, lease, and bequeath his personal property. 6. The right of petition. Representative government assumes the right of citizens to be heard. The privilege of petition is inherent in free citizenship. 7. The right to rule. It is not enough to be heard. The power of petition must progress to the actual management of the government. 8. Universal suffrage. Representative government presupposes an intelligent, efficient, and universal electorate. The character of such a government will ever be determined by the character and caliber of those who compose it. As civilization progresses, suffrage, while remaining universal for both sexes, will be effectively modified, regrouped, and otherwise differentiated. 9. Control of public servants. No civil government will be serviceable and effective unless the citizenry possess the wise techniques of guiding and controlling office holders and public servants.
You missed a word in there, which was that unless the citizenry possesses and use
wise techniques
of guiding and control.
Great, good, thank you. And number 10, intelligent and trained representation. The survival of democracy is dependent on successful representative government, and that is conditioned upon the practice of electing to public offices only those individuals who are technically trained, intellectually competent, socially loyal, and morally fit. Only by such provisions can government of the people, by the people, and for the people be preserved.
Wow. That's a pretty heavy section.
And I love that one. Because there again, we're seeing that balance that they're that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What do we really want? Do we want a true, high evolutionary representative government? If we do, these are the things that we must provide for. And, you know, what comes back to me always is the tendency in the world to have corruption in government and the tendency in the world to allow government to make all the rules and then they take care of their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they take care of their own interests. I see that. And I think that this what really hits home to me is this idea of the reign of law, freedom of speech, all of these, security of property.
Freedom of the mind.
Yes, the freedom.
Unless free people are educated, taught to think and
right.
plan wisely, then freedom can do more harm than good.
And you know what I've seen some shows recently about civics and how civics is hardly even taught in high school anymore, and I'm thinking, my oh my, why would that be the case when civics should
when
be...
When we most need it.
Yes. That is how we would have a well-educated electorate, if they understand their own system of government and how they can participate in it, and that they have the right to petition it, they have freedom of speech, you know, and that they must hold their elected leaders accountable because of the reign of law. And there must be control of public servants. You know, to me, it's huge that civics is not taught in a lot of high schools anymore. It's shocking, really.
Yeah, we just know so little about how our government works or how it should work or our
mm-hmm.
Constitution.
Mm-hmm. And the vision of our founding fathers, who were, in my opinion, seeing a glimpse of the future in the realest sense. They were not perfect men by any means, but what they created, the foundation they created for our government and for our system was enlightened, I think. They didn't always live up to it. And go ahead. Huh?
It was just one of the very few states, other than perhaps the European Union. But other than that, it's probably one of the few states that wasn't wholly or purely an evolutionary institution, because it was one where they really sat down and thought about what they wanted to create and how they wanted it to be different from previous governments and from, you know, all of the rest of the governments in the world at that time.
Right.
It was a huge step forward and away from monarchy.
Right. And I wanted to bring out something here, which is by way of a cross-reference, if you'll indulge me a little bit. Back in the Jesus Papers, it tells us that, you know, Jesus does a talk on sovereignty. And how, you know, we need to lose sovereignty and national sovereignty, religious sovereignty, I think personal sovereignty, anything. And of course, going back to what Brian was talking about, and I'm absolutely loving Brian's book. I'm finishing it now.
Brian McLaren.
Yeah. Oh, man. He's one of my heroes now. I just love the guy. And, this idea of sovereignty is just so, and the Urantia book comes right out and says that that is the disease right now. War is not the disease, sovereignty is, national sovereignty. But the Jesus does this talk, and then the midwayers give us a commentary on what he said. And one of the things they said is, the 48, and this tells you when it was written, it was back before we were 50 states, the 48 American free states live together in peace They are among the citizens of these 48 states. There are among the citizens of these 48 states of all the various nationalities and races that live in the ever-warring nations of Europe. These Americans represent almost all the religions and religious sects and cults of the whole world. And yet, here in North America, they live together in peace. And all this is made possible because these states have surrendered their sovereignty and have abandoned all notions of the supposed rights of self-determination. And it goes on to say that they've surrendered this sovereignty to a federal government. And it is this federal government with its overarching laws that provides the superstructure for which these states, these relatively independent and decidedly different states, can live together in peace. And so, you know, it's interesting because sometimes I you know, you can see how, you know, there's a tendency to be too much government, but then you can also, you have to go back and appreciate that it's that government that allows us to live in peace as 50 now completely diverse states. And it's because of that, what we just read in that section, the reign of law. And Jesus went on to say in that lecture that he gives, that's in the Jesus Papers, that freedom is made possible because of law. And it's the one place in the book where the word shows up in all caps. Freedom is made possible because of law. And he goes on to say that if one man is to be absolutely free, another man will become an absolute slave. And there again, that's about balance.
And I think that's a really crucial thing right now, because a lot of the ideas and ideals of freedom that exist within aspects of our society is sort of a freedom from laws and a freedom from regulation that allows individuals to really have almost unbridled freedom.
Right. And again, unbridled freedom and unmitigated selfishness are the marks of the rebellion, right?
Well, let's read on.
Yeah.
Section 3, the ideals of statehood. The political or administrative form of a government is of little consequence provided it affords the essentials of civil progress: liberty, security, education, and social coordination. It is not what a state is, but what it does that determines the course of social evolution. And after all, no state can transcend the moral values of its citizenry as exemplified in their chosen leaders. Ignorance and selfishness will ensure the downfall of even the highest type of government. Much as it is to be regretted, national egotism has been essential to social survival. The chosen people doctrine has been a prime factor in tribal welding and nation building right on down to modern times. But no state can attain ideal levels of functioning until every form of intolerance is mastered. Wow, that says a lot. Every form of intolerance is mastered. Mm-hmm. It is everlastingly inimical to human progress. And intolerance is best combated by the coordination of science, commerce, play, and religion. The ideal state functions under the impulse of three mighty and coordinated drives. 1. Love loyalty derived from the realization of human brotherhood. 2. Intelligent patriotism based on wise ideals. 3. cosmic insight interpreted in terms of planetary facts, needs, and goals.
Mm.
The laws of the ideal state are few in number, and they have passed out of the negativistic taboo age into the era of positive progress of individual liberty, consequent upon enhanced self-control. The exalted state not only compels its citizens to work, but also entices them into profitable and uplifting utilization of the increasing leisure which results from toil liberation by the advancing machine age. Leisure must produce as well as consume.
Mm.
Wow, that's a biggie.
Wow.
Maybe we should have that up on some billboards.
Yeah.
No society has progressed very far when it permits idleness or tolerates poverty. But poverty and dependence can never be eliminated if the defective and degenerate stocks are freely supported and permitted to reproduce without restraint. The moral society should aim to preserve the self-respect of its citizenry and afford every normal individual adequate opportunity for self-realization. Such a plan of social achievement would yield a cultural society of the highest order. Social evolution should be encouraged by governmental supervision, which exercises a minimum of regulative control. That state is best which coordinates most while governing least. That is a statement that I think we find quite confusing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to understand exactly how that happens. You know, it seems sort of contradictory, but we can come back to that later when we discuss the paper.
Yeah,
the
that's
ideal,
a thought-provoking one.
It is.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I'll read that paragraph again.
Yeah, read that
one again.
A
moral society should aim to preserve the self-respect of its citizenry and afford every normal individual adequate opportunity for self-realization. Such a plan of social achievement would yield a cultural society of the highest order. Social evolution should be encouraged by governmental supervision, which exercises a minimum of regulative control. That state is best which coordinates most while governing least. The ideals of statehood must be attained by evolution, by the slow growth of civic consciousness, the recognition of the obligation and privilege of social service. At first, men assume the burdens of government as a duty, following the end of the administration of political spoilsmen. But later on, they seek such ministry as a privilege, as the greatest honor. The status of any level of civilization is faithfully portrayed by the caliber of its citizens who volunteer to accept the responsibilities of statehood. In a real commonwealth, the business of governing cities and provinces is conducted by experts and is managed just as are all other forms of economic and commercial associations of people. In advanced states, political service is esteemed as the highest devotion of the citizenry. The greatest ambition of the wisest and noblest of citizens is to gain civil recognition, to be elected or appointed to some position of governmental trust. And such governments confer their highest honors of recognition for service upon their civil and social servants. Honors are next bestowed in the order named upon philosophers, educators, scientists, industrialists, and militarists. parents are duly rewarded by the excellency of their children, and purely religious leaders, being ambassadors of a spiritual kingdom, receive their real rewards in another world.
Okay, so you got that, you purely religious leaders out there? You have to wait to get your...
Don't expect a lot of material reward for that effort.
My dear friend Dwayne Faw used to say about that particular paragraph, well, when you work for God, the pay isn't that great, but the benefits are out of this world.
Indeed.
Yeah. So this is just such a thought-provoking section for me. And because it really talks about a shift in perception. And again, I want to come back to something Brian McLaren says in his book about commonwealth. He sees it as another word for the kingdom of God, the commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
And
kind of literally.
Yes. And being the religious person that I am, the spiritual person that I am, and loving God the way that I do, and loving God's children the way that I do, I think I've said on the show before, and I know you join me in this 100%, Krislyn, everywhere I go in the world, I fall in love with God's children, and I don't see race anymore, and I don't see social strata. I don't see anything like that. What I see is this beautiful spirit of God shining through the eyes of his children, and I see it in every place I've gone. And this indelible human spirit that perseveres no matter what. And the highest honor I see, the ideals of statehood, that you know, oftentimes what we see in the governments of the world are people who want to have power and they want it for the wrong reasons. They want it for self-aggrandizement. They don't want it because they want to serve humanity and make life better. And that's certainly not everybody. We know that's not true for everyone, but we see these types come to power often.
Well, and we hear people talk about, you know, there are good people in government. There are good people who want to serve, but they're not necessarily the people who have all the power.
Right. And oftentimes, right now, what we see in our own country is if they don't have a lot of money and a lot of backing by people who have a lot of money, you know, they don't get very far. So that's it's interesting that those who really want to, perhaps those who are statesmen, who are educators. I mean, they give us this list of honors.
How and, we will honor in the future.
Right. And
philosophers,
educators,
they assume those burdens as a duty, but later they seek such ministry as a privilege.
Right.
And they use the term ministry, you know, in British commonwealth, they use the term minister of justice or minister of industry or minister of education. They refer to their leaders as ministers.
Yes.
And it's when we think in terms of what the term ministry really means, it is about service, isn't
it? In the highest sense, it is. It is about service. And I think going back to the three sections and the ideals, I mean, keep in mind this paper, and just here for a momentary check-in with our listeners, we're reading Development of the State, paper 71 from the Urantia book, written by Melchizedek, who teaches in the local universe. And, he's telling us here in section 3 that we just read, the ideals of statehood. And they give us those three ideals. The ideal state functions under the impulse of three mighty and coordinated drives. Love, loyalty, derived from the realization of human brotherhood. That's serving for the right motivation, right? There you go. That's right there. That's the right motivation. Love is always the highest and best motivation. Intelligent patriotism based on wise ideals, you know, not just blind loyalty, because that's what my dad always did, you know, or whatever it is, you know. Intelligent patriotism.
My country, right or wrong.
My forefathers died for freedom of speech. I know that. They died for freedom of religion. And I want my Muslim brothers and sisters to be as free as I am. Because they died for that. My fathers died for that. And I don't want that their blood to be wasted. So I honor that any religion in this wonderful country has the right of expression and nonviolent expression, as we read earlier, obviously, but that right to express their point of view, and I honor that. I would die for that. Cosmic insight. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to read that cosmic insight. Go ahead.
Interpreted in terms of planetary facts, needs, and goals. You know, so to see the need of your own country is great and very important. Also, we have to see how we fit into the rest of the world. And I think that's what's becoming increasingly difficult for us. You know, the world is flat now. The internet has changed everything. We look at human history, and we look at certain events in human history that changed everything. Certainly the printing press is one of them. The internet, I think, is the next evolution.
Well, and I think the expansion of film and of television outside of our culture and, you know, expanding the globe, that has had a great deal of influence on how we are seen by other cultures.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the ideals that they thought this country stood for in some ways have been denigrated by the kinds of entertainment we've sort of sent out representing us.
Over the airwaves.
Well, yeah.
One of the pitfalls of our friends. Yep.
We want to get through this paper and then we'll take phone calls. So
yeah.
Let me continue with section 4.
Okay.
Progressive civilization. Economics, society, and government must evolve if they are to remain. Static conditions on an evolutionary world are indicative of decay. Only those institutions which move forward with the evolutionary stream persist. The progressive program of an expanding civilization embraces 1. Preservation of individual liberties. 2. Protection of the home. 3. Promotion of economic security. 4. Prevention of disease. 5. Compulsory education. 6. Compulsory employment. 7. Profitable utilization of leisure. 8. Care of the unfortunate. 9. Race improvement. 10. Promotion of science and art. 11. Promotion of philosophy, wisdom. 12. Augmentation of cosmic insight, spirituality. And this progress in the arts of civilization leads directly to the realization of the highest human and divine goals of mortal endeavor. The social achievement of the brotherhood of man and the personal status of God consciousness, which becomes revealed in the supreme desire of every individual to do the will of the Father in heaven. The appearance of genuine brotherhood signifies that a social order has arrived in which all men delight in bearing one another's burdens. Mm-hmm. They actually desire to practice the golden rule. But such an ideal society cannot be realized when either the weak or the wicked lie in wait to take unfair and unholy advantage of those who are chiefly actuated by devotion to the service of truth, beauty, and goodness. In such a situation, only one course is practical. The golden rulers may establish a progressive society in which they live according to their ideals while maintaining an adequate defense against their benighted fellows who might seek either to exploit their pacific predilections or to destroy their advancing civilization. Idealism can never survive on an evolving planet if the idealists in each generation permit themselves to be exterminated by the baser orders of humanity. And here is the great test of idealism. Can an advanced society maintain that military preparedness which renders it secure from all attack by its war-loving neighbors without yielding to the temptation to employ this military strength in offensive operations against other peoples for purposes of selfish gain or national aggrandizement? National survival demands preparedness, and religious idealism alone can prevent the prostitution of preparedness into aggression. Only love, brotherhood, can prevent the strong from oppressing the weak.
Wow.
Whoa.
That one I see as, you know, uniquely America's problem, because we have the strongest military in the world. And which I said earlier on the board, we often become a target because of it. But I think that, you know, this is our challenge as a country. Can we protect ourselves and our advancing civilization without using our mighty military as the aggressor?
Right.
Tough stuff. You know, oftentimes we become the policemen of the world, too. And again, you know, those laws, freedom is made possible because of law. Those laws, I think many of us could all agree on, you know, laws that protect women and children, laws that protect property and wealth. You know, so again, there's balance. We have law on one side, our regulation, and on the other side we have freedom, the ability to express ourselves. You know, our challenge is to find the balance. And again, he holds up, the Melchizedek holds up love. Brotherhood is the one thing that can achieve that balance. So I hope you guys are writing down some questions, because we're going to open up the phones here and we really want to hear from you. Get ready. We're almost through the paper. We said it's short. Another couple sections.
You want to read on?
Yep. Section 5, evolution of competition. Competition is essential to social progress, but competition, unregulated, breeds violence. In current society, competition is slowly displacing war in that it determines the individual's place in industry, as well as decreeing the survival of the industries themselves. Murder and war differ in their status before the mores, murder having been outlawed since the early days of society, while war has never yet been outlawed by mankind as a whole. The ideal state undertakes to regulate social conduct only enough to take violence out of individual competition and to prevent unfairness in personal initiative. Here is a great problem in statehood. How can you guarantee peace and quiet in industry, pay the taxes to support state power, and at the same time prevent taxation from handicapping industry and keep the state from becoming parasitical or tyrannical? Throughout the earlier ages of any world, competition is essential to progress, to progressive civilization. As the evolution of man progresses, cooperation becomes increasingly effective. In addition to civilizations, cooperation is more efficient than competition. I'm having a little hard time seeing. I think I might need to get some reading glasses here at some point. Early man, and welcome to the club, right?
Mm-hmm.
Early man is stimulated by competition. Early evolution is characterized by the survival of the biologically fit, but later civilizations are the better promoted by intelligent cooperation, understanding fraternity, and spiritual brotherhood. True competition in industry is exceedingly wasteful and highly ineffective, but no attempt to eliminate this economic lost motion should be countenanced if such adjustments entail even the slightest abrogation of any of the basic liberties of the individual.
Wow, that's pretty profound.
So competition has to be replaced by cooperation.
Indeed.
And, you know, that's hard for us to see how that would work, isn't it? It's hard to envision how that might work, but it does. I have faith that it does, because it's the only way any of us ever get by. If we compete, you can see how warring tribes are in competition for the same resources.
Mm-hmm.
In cooperation, they find more resources. They work together and create more resources so that both will thrive.
Well, and if they were really looking out for the good of the whole, not even necessarily the whole nation, but the whole world, you know, and then, you know, some of these perplexing problems would probably be easier to solve. Like they said, I guess this is in the next paper where they talk about the profit motive.
Mm-hmm. No, actually, yeah, the next section.
So read on. 6, the profit motive. Present-day profit-motivated economics is doomed unless profit motives can be augmented by service motives. Ruthless competition based on narrow-minded self-interest is ultimately destructive of even those things which it seeks to maintain. Exclusive and self-serving profit motivation is incompatible with Christian ideals, much more incompatible with the teachings of Jesus. In economics, profit motivation is to service motivation what fear is to love in religion. But the profit motive must not be suddenly destroyed or removed. It keeps many otherwise slothful mortals hard at work. It is not necessary, however, that this social energy arouser be forever selfish in its objectives. The profit motive of economic activities is altogether base and wholly unworthy of an advanced order of society. Nevertheless, it is an indispensable factor throughout the earlier phases of civilization. Guess that shows us where we are, huh?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Profit motivation must not be taken away from men until they have firmly possessed themselves of superior types of non-profit motives for economic striving and social serving. The transcendent urges of superlative wisdom, including brotherhood. Intriguing brotherhood. And excellency of spiritual attainment.
Mm. That one's huge, I think.
It really
and,
is.
You know, and it really is about right motivations. And sometimes, you know, we certainly see in our own economic situation where profit motive has gone rampantly.
Has run amok
and really doesn't care about the people that supposedly this product is supposed to serve now. All it really is worried about is increasing the shareholder's bottom line. And it really,
if you think about just what's happened in industry in the last 100 years, you see this profound movement away from industries that were really designed to serve and to produce and to create something of value to institutions that have just sort of become real parasites on the people
on humanity.
That they're designed to serve.
In a way, it's so true, and I love the big corporations that create jobs for people, good jobs for people, but I personally believe that we can keep creating jobs for people and keep the motivation more service oriented than always exclusively profit oriented.
And we know of a lot of very sort of progressive corporations that have really made a new culture out
mm-hmm.
of industry
mm-hmm.
that have really been designed to serve not only their customers but also the people who work within them. You know, there have been some really inspiring examples of that. And then you have other examples of almost rampant corruption.
Right.
But let's read on.
And toxic culture, too. I just want to mention that in industries, you know, like Enron. Enron kind of brought to light how some corporations are almost cult-like in their culture.
Where corruption is so the order of the day that it's
right.
barely even recognized as corruption anymore.
It's systemic, yeah. Okay, so here's number 7, section 7. In paper 71, Development of the State, Education. The enduring state is founded on culture, dominated by ideals and motivated by service. The purpose of education should be acquirement of skill, pursuit of wisdom, realization of selfhood, and attainment of spiritual values. In the ideal state, education continues throughout life, and philosophy sometime becomes the chief pursuit of its citizens. The citizens of such a commonwealth pursue wisdom as an enhancement of insight into the significance of human relations, the meanings of reality, the nobility of values, the goals of living, and the glories of cosmic destiny. Urantians should get a vision of a new and higher cultural society. Education will jump to new levels of value with the passing of the purely profit-motivated system of economics. Education has too long been localistic, militaristic, ego-exalting, and success-seeking. It must eventually become worldwide, idealistic, self-realizing, and cosmic grasping. Education recently passed from the control of the clergy to that of lawyers and businessmen. Eventually, it must be given over to the philosophers and the scientists. Teachers must be free beings, real leaders, to the end that philosophy, the search for wisdom, may become the chief educational pursuit. Education is the business of living. It must continue throughout a lifetime so that mankind may gradually experience the ascending levels of mortal wisdom, which are 1. The knowledge of things. 2. The realization of meanings. 3. The appreciation of values. 4. The nobility of work, duty. 5. The motivation of goals, morality. 6. The love of service, character. 7. Cosmic insight, spiritual discernment. And then, by means of these achievements, many will ascend to the mortal ultimate of mind attainment, God consciousness.
Wow.
That section.
That really would be a mighty ideal for an educational system to strive for, wouldn't it?
Oh, wow. Yeah. And to make it compulsory, you know, I mean, I just think they really, this was a bit of a smackdown, you know, when they tell us that education has been too materialist or too militaristic, ego-exalting, and success-seeking. And
well, until recently, almost all of Western education was, or at least North American and some of European, but at least most of North American education was based on the educational goals of British gentry from 300 years ago.
Well, yeah.
300 or 400 years ago.
Well, we have one more section, Crystalline.
The Character of Statehood, Section 8. The only sacred feature of any human government is the division of statehood into the three domains of executive, legislative, and judicial functions. I have to just interrupt and say that has always fascinated me, that mm-hmm. that is considered a sacred feature.
Well, there's the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
There it is.
The universe is administered in accordance with such a plan of segregation of functions and authority. Aside from this divine concept of effective social regulation or civil government, it matters little what form of state a people may elect to have, provided the citizenry is ever progressing toward the goal of augmented self-control and increased social service. The intellectual keenness, economic wisdom, social cleverness, and moral stamina of a people are all faithfully reflected in statehood. The evolution of statehood entails progress from level to level as follows. 1. The creation of a threefold government of executive, legislative, and judicial branches. 2. The freedom of social, political, and religious activities. 3. The abolition of all forms of slavery and human bondage. 4. The ability of the citizenry to control the levying of taxes. 5. The establishment of universal education, learning extended from the cradle to the grave. 6. The proper adjustment between local and national governments. 7. The fostering of science and the conquest of disease. 8. The due recognition of sex equality and the coordinated functioning of men and women in the home, school, and church with specialized service of women in industry and government. 9. The elimination of toiling slavery by machine invention and the subsequent mastery of the machine age. 10. The conquest of dialects, the triumph of a universal language. 11. The ending of war. International adjudication of national and racial differences by continental courts of nations, presided over by a supreme planetary tribunal automatically recruited from the periodically retiring heads of the continental courts. The continental courts are authoritative. The world court is advisory, moral. 12. The worldwide vogue of the pursuit of wisdom, the exaltation of philosophy, the evolution of a world religion, which will presage the entrance of the planet upon the earlier phases of settlement of light and life, in light and life. These are the prerequisites of the progressive government and the earmarks of ideal statehood. Urantia is far from the realization of these exalted ideals, but the civilized races have made a beginning. Mankind is on the march toward higher evolutionary destinies.
And there you go. Sponsored by Melchizedek of Nebanon. And what do? They go through the universe and teach this very kind of thing. This is their specialty. You know,
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So that's it, folks. That's paper 71, Development of the State.
The shortest paper in the entire book.
Yeah. And yet it still has 8 sections, yet they're very succinct and amazing, really. And now we want to open it up if you want to give us a call. The board has been real lively, and so I say to any of you guys that want to call and let's talk about this. You know, we missed Andre today. We missed that male perspective. And so we'd love to hear from some of you out there, and women too, whatever, whoever likes to call. The call-in number is 646-716-8158. Lou Bart just said, that's just one Melchizedek's opinion. Thank you, Lou. That is one Melchizedek's opinion. And our friend Steve McIntosh likes to say that. And I love that. I think that's a healthy attitude. And I think Melchizedek would appreciate that we would think for ourselves about these things. And he's given us a lot to think about, the ideals of statehood and the evolution and where we might take it. And I love the way he ended that paper. He says, we got a long way to go, but the civilized races have made a beginning. Mankind is on the march.
We are on the march.
Yeah, we are on the march. And
just when you
think
all hope is lost, just when you feel like things are really spiraling downward, or we have so many of the elements of the collapse of an empire, or the degradation of a civilization. But then you look around and you see that there are so many things that really are improving. You know, it might be hard to see that in one 4-year election period, or even one decade or two. But if you look back over a generation or two, you do start to see that there has been progress made.
Yeah, you know, I like this summer we had
We had Steve McIntosh. He was our keynote speaker at our summer seminar. And he was talking about spiral dynamics and the dynamics of evolution. And he was talking about how we tack off each other. So, you know, which is really interesting. I mean, there is a push and pull, a tug back and forth, but we tack off of each other. And in this way, through the conflict, there is growth. And we learn something from one another, maybe albeit reluctantly. Still, we learn from each other. And, you know, and this is where you come to that spirit of cooperation instead of that antagonistic competition, you know. And you see it in religions. Going back again to Brian's book, he's asking Christians to take on that spirit, that true spirit of cooperation. How can I make life better for every other religion on earth? Sincerely better. How can I become strong and benevolent? Wanting to help and uphold rather than, you know, divide and conquer. And, you know, you just see that.
And then we see how we respond when we're in some kind of a natural disaster or a national crisis, you know, like what happened to the entire eastern, northeastern seaboard in the United States this last week, where so many communities were really damaged by a storm that was really quite the storm of storms for this part of the country, something they had never seen before. And just the way that people come together and work together, even politically, you know, the partisan politics of an election get thrown out the window for people to come together and work together and try to pull things back together so that, you know, lives can get back to some semblance of normalcy as quickly as possible.
And that is what makes us great. That spirit of cooperation, that spirit that pulls together, is what makes us great. And it is what makes us persevere.
It's recognizable by our leaders and by the rest of the world as one of the things that is special about particular nations when they do that.
Right. And when we fall into that base place of fear where, you know, I mean, one of the things that I've noticed that's been somewhat lost in American politics is this willingness to jump in after an election and cooperate with the person who was elected. To say, you know, okay, the people have chosen, so now let's make the most of that. And that is, you know, as I understand it from the Urantia book, a basic universal paradigm, because even the angels, you know, the book says they won't coerce us, they won't try to force us to do anything. But once we do decide, once we've made a wholehearted decision, they will help us make the most of that decision. And what that tells me is, you know, every decision we make could be a growth decision if we make the most of it. Oftentimes we make a decision and then we don't, it's not a consecrated decision. We flip-flop, you know what I mean?
Yes, definitely.
We second-guess ourselves. Well, maybe that wasn't the right decision. Oh, well, I shouldn't have gone there. Well.
Oh, not you know. Me. I've never done that.
Well, I think that's probably what causes so much divorce. you know, we go into a decision in a lackadaisical way. We don't realize the nature and gravity of it. We don't think about it.
One of the things that really catches my eye every time I read the paper that we just read was the idea of that, you know, a real civilized state or a really high level of statehood promotes the concept of education from the cradle to the grave. And every time I read that, I think about, you know, how we expect our children to make major life decisions about what they're going to do for the rest of their lives and their educational process by the time they're done with high school.
Mm-hmm.
And really, how many of us know at that age? I mean, I know a few people who've been really consecrated in that decision at a very early age, but the majority of us barely know who we are by that point in our lives, let alone what would be the best path for us to take for our life's work. And what about when the field that we chose at that age evaporates, you know, by the time we're middle-aged?
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't have any system that supports, you know, education from the cradle to the grave.
Right. And what about when only the wealthy can afford a college education?
Any education past
a certain
level, other than the most basic education.
You know, I think I appreciate that that employment is should be compulsory. Find something to do. Even Jesus said that. Find something to do, and do that with all your heart.
Find something to do which really needs to be done.
Yeah, yeah. And he also said in Instructions for Teachers and Believers, he said, do everything in your power to help your fellows who find themselves without employment to find employment, you know. And I think, you know, those are the things that, and that, you know, the Melchizedek said another thing that he just kept saying, Chris, and I don't know if you noticed it or not, but he mentioned self-realization several times.
Mm-hmm.
In different ways. He said it in different ways.
Right.
And I throw this out there to you guys on the board, too. What do you think he meant by that? What does self-realization mean? That would be a nice thing to have Larry Mullins come on and talk about sometime, because he wrote a whole book about it, about self-realization, and we know that that's been something that's come to the forefront. To realize, and at least I don't, what I think that means, at least for me, what it means is to realize your own full potential. To be able to do, you know, what is that great quote from the Urantia book that says, many noble human impulses die because nobody is there to hear them.
All right. Yeah, I love that. Love that quote also.
Yeah.
And imagine how many noble human impulses die because they don't have any mentorship. They don't have any support in educating themselves to be able to do those things which they feel most passionately motivated to do.
Right.
Well, and just the idea that we have in another part of the Urantia book where it states that the real focus and function of education should be the development of a majestic personality.
Yes.
What does that mean? What does a majestic personality look like?
Self-realization.
Mm-hmm.
And self-respect. You know, that was another thing they touched on. How can you...
And self-control.
Right. Oh, man. Several times you mentioned self-control. Oh, we have a caller. Let's take this call.
All right.
Area code 603, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hey, Paula and Kristen, it's Lou from New Hampshire.
Hi, Lou.
Good afternoon in your neck of the woods.
Yeah. 1:30 here.
Speaking of your neck of the woods, how are you doing out there?
Up here in northern New Hampshire, we've got rain and, you know, I would say moderate winds, but nothing serious. Nothing like they got clobbered on the coast. So we're fine, even though I brought batteries and candles and food and gas in the tank and everything else. We're fine up here.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, happy to hear that.
Thank you. I have a couple of comments.
Yay.
One was generated by the very first sentence that Crystal read about the most efficient and enduring state is composed of a single nation whose people have a common language, mores, and institutions. Now, Pat Buchanan wrote a book called The Suicide of a Superpower, where you would swear this guy has read the Urantia book with some of the advanced concepts he's portraying. And he's talking about, I think, don't misunderstand me, my people come from elsewhere. We're not American Indians. But there was a time when America, except for the African slaves, when America was pretty much Western Europeans, white Western Europeans, Christian. And so there was this unity of some of the most basic cultural elements, race and religion, that made America really strong.
And now, language.
And language. And I want to talk about language, because my people were peasants from Sicily who came over in the early part of the last century, and they worked their tails off, but they refused to speak. They had five children. They refused to speak their peasant Sicilian dialect at home because they wanted their children to learn English. There was no even thought or idea of trying to hang on to an ancient language in a new world. They were so happy and proud to be here. They were so nationalistic and proud to be Americans that the whole language thing for their children was totally off the table. Totally off the table. And I want to point to some of the things that are happening today where whose a single nation, whose people have a common language, mores, and institutions. I've always thought from day one of the founding fathers these rich white men, seemed to have a sense that America was the new Zion, and they were indeed taking part in the destiny of history, and that they were...
That America was a new what?
Zion. The new Israel.
Oh, Zion. Okay.
And that they were taking place in the destiny of history, and that they were somehow divinely guided. And I think that's not a myth, because I always thought America was the great melting pot experiment of the Most Highs. And I think it's still going on, and I think the melting pot is getting bigger and more inclusive and broadening its membership, because we're not all, you know, white Western Christian Europeans anymore. The whole immigration complexion has changed a great deal just in the last 50 years, I would say since World War II probably. So this is still ongoing, and these challenges of a unified people, unified mores and institutions and languages is probably even more pressing today than it's ever been in this country. Now, as I postulate that America is probably the great melting pot experience of the Most Highs, I think the European Union, I think the Most Highs have their fingers in that too, as the very first incremental evolutionary step toward a world government. And I think it's the first step toward that. But I want to get back to, and everybody can draw their own conclusions here. I just want to state some facts. After the tsunami in Japan, which, as we all know, is almost 100% pure, a racially pure society, everyone spoke about the great law and order, the great respect, the great standing in line, and lack of looting. And everyone in the whole world commented on this.
Uh-huh.
Now, at this very moment, as I speak, right now, in New Jersey and Staten Island and New York, looting is going on right now. This would not have happened in Japan, but in a racially pure society, but it happens here in America, the great melting pot society.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing those out as facts. I'm not making any equations to anything, but I think they ought to speak for themselves.
I hadn't heard about that until you mentioned it.
I heard it last night on CNN, you know.
Mm.
So, it's a desperate situation down there. Well, it's a desperate situation down there. The weather is cold. People have no fuel. They have no food. They have no water. I don't judge it. I don't know how I would react under similar circumstances. I don't want to judge it. I'm just sort of stating some facts here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really all I have to say. This book by Buchanan, Suicide of Superpowers, is pretty amazing. I think our challenges are great. I think if we just got rid of the corruption in government, you'd find the American people can solve anything. If corruption doesn't get in the way and retarded, I have great faith in the people of this country.
Well, I don't think we're dealing with just a corruption of government. I think we're dealing with a corruption that is somewhat ubiquitous in so many of our institutions.
Well, corporations, which are by the government, but, you know, they.
Right.
I have to go somewhere, but if you just permit me, one, as long as we're on this subject of Americans and problem solving, you know, we are such a great people. We built the Empire State Building in 1 year. 1 year. It took 20 years to build the Trade Towers, but we built the Empire State Building just as tall. In 1 year, there was no OSHA, there were no unions, there was a depression, and men needed to work, and they worked their tails off. We built Hoover Dam, I'm old enough to call it Boulder Dam, but we built Hoover Dam on budget and under schedule, one of the most monumental man-made structures on the planet. Why? Same thing. There was no OSHA, there were no unions, there was a depression, and men just worked their tails off, and we built these monumental things. We went to the moon within 10 years of its announcement and returned these men safely back home. We cracked the atomic bomb under the pressure of World War in record time.
Yeah.
And yet, here's the sad part. And yet, over 40 years ago, the Arabs strangled us with an oil embargo. And we've had 40 years to solve this problem of energy independence. And we haven't done it. Why? It's so obvious to me. It's because of the political influence that the oil companies have on Washington. We can solve them with anything. We've demonstrated it time and time and time again.
When we're not completely hogtied.
40 years. And we went to the moon just in the decade of its announcement. And this, this is something that is always, if I want to get my tackle raised, this is the issue that really sets me over the edge. Okay, I've got to go. I'm gonna hang up.
Thanks
now.
Thanks for calling in.
You can all throw darts at me when I'm gone here, okay?
No, thank you.
Good job, guys. Good job.
Thank you, Lou.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Ditto. Well,
one of the things that I find very interesting about that topic that he just raised are some of the ideas, if not outright suggestions. You know, I don't think we're very often given, you know, here, you should do this kind of directives in the Urantia book. But the few places we are, one of the things that has moved me is this idea that on a government on a neighboring planet where all of the natural resources are considered to be the property of the nation, and it can't be privately owned.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they pay for Social Security. That's how they pay for, you know, caring for those who are not able to work. And, you know, there's also some very harsh kinds of ideas by contemporary values about how to deal with the perpetual, what would you call it, not the prison population, but the perpetual criminal elements.
Well, right,
you know.
And I think Lou touched on that. He mentioned the Japanese culture, which we know is the yellow race, and the Urantia book says that the white races have never surpassed the yellow race in group ethics, personal morality, or family loyalty. Those three things: group ethics, personal morality, and family loyalty. So I would think that the yellow race, and as you go on, and I highly recommend people go on and read paper 72, Government on a Neighboring Planet, again by Melchizedek, and they got special permission to give us that paper. The two predominant races in that paper are yellow and blue, and it's a mixture, an admixture, and I would suggest that I think the yellow race is definitely more of one mind, and they're more culturally minded. And so that's why group ethics are easier for them, and
we're
more
told
important
that they
for them.
Have very, very strong families.
Right. And gee, you know, it would be a disgrace to loot, you know, and steal from somebody, especially under the circumstances when we really need to pull together and help each other. But we've got two more callers, so.
Oh, wonderful.
Should, yeah. And we got some time. Hey, area code 214, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, it's me. This is Hi. David in Dallas.
Hi,
Dave.
I want you to know this is all Crystalline's fault.
It is. Okay.
Oh no.
Did me as a member.
Oh. We're glad you came, David. Thank you. Have you been listening to the show? Did you?
Oh yeah.
Read that?
I read the
yeah,
paper first
good.
This morning and then listened to the whole show.
Great.
So. Yeah, I went to Brian McLaren's meeting, as I said, a couple of weeks ago. I haven't been able to tune in because of work, but got together with him. Well, I haven't met him yet. My TA said, you'd be proud of me. My TA said, just sit down and listen. And don't say anything. Anyway.
He gave you some good advice.
That's
there,
always
huh?
a challenge for all of us, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Paula, I'm sure you described how you turned your life and your will over to God
mm-hmm.
numbers of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm sure you experienced then being elevated into the kingdom of heaven, right?
What I experienced really was being inaugurated into the service of man.
That's right.
And I think that is the same thing, though. Let me clarify that I think that is
But you're,
the same
you,
thing.
You are a cosmic citizen, but you are living on this planet. It changed your perspective.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that right?
Yes, it changed everything. And I mean, even finding the Arantia book changed
all
everything.
Changes.
But when I put my hand up and said, okay, I surrender, I give it all to you, I don't have an agenda anymore.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we're driven by his will because we have subjected our will to his. We said, it is my will that your will be done.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I've been on hold for about 20 years.
Mm.
And as I told you, I got into the UB about 4 months ago. But I was called back in with seven words. And it's not like... three-letter word like jobs. It was seven words, which is the iniquity of the Amorites is full.
Mm.
Now, what that portends is that the kingdom of heaven is getting ready to move. And
well, we feel that, don't we? I mean, everybody I talk to feels
this should be a confirmation to everybody. Mm-hmm. Because the power is going on, the heat is going up, and everybody's going to have to make a choice, the kingdom of heaven or the kingdoms of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this works is like a spiritual battle of 2 Chronicles 20, when the Lord does the fighting. But we have to be on the battlefield praising him. And let me just run this by everybody. The when iniquity is full, self-destruction has run its course.
David, do you have your computer on? Because I'm hearing a bit of an echo.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that.
I'm completely off.
Okay.
I'm hearing the echo of myself. Anyway, when we join the kingdom of heaven and we are, our weapons of our warfare are not carnal, what happens is the enemy turns on each other, they destroy themselves, and we are there to pick up the pieces.
Yeah.
See if that computes with anybody. And in that case, there's going to be a lot of change in the next couple of years.
Well, you know, our work's cut out for us. There's
That's
no
right.
Doubt. There's no doubt in my mind about that. And, you know, what happens, I think, is when we, you know, when the truth is revealed to us, and I think I have felt ever since the early, since 1990, is when I started feeling spiritually that the Spirit of Truth was at work, revealing truth to us in ways that we probably didn't expect. And everything we witness now is like a Rorschach test. It brings up issues for us. And we have to look at that. We have to look at that honestly and fearlessly and say, what does that mean to me? And, you know, if you're a lover of truth, then you love the truth no matter whether it's what you wanted to hear or not. And you say, when Father reveals truth to you, when the Spirit of Truth reveals truth to you, or Michael, Master Spirit of Truth reveals truth to you, you say, thank you. I didn't really want to know that. You know, that's painful to me. I feel betrayed. I feel, you know, bereft. But thank you, because now I know. And I would rather know than not know. And I think that's, you know, it's absolutely important to love the truth and to be willing to hear it no matter what, because, you know, now you're liberated by it. It's like my friend Tom says, I'd rather be disillusioned than illusioned.
Right.
And I'd rather know where I stand. And hold on with us, David, for a minute, because we have another caller, and we're down to 13 minutes. I want to get this other caller on as well, okay?
Great.
So hang on here. Area code 575, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Yeah, hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hi, this Who's is this? Jim. Jim
oh,
in
hi,
New Mexico.
Jim. How you doing?
Oh,
good
it's a beautiful day here. Yeah.
Good, it is here, too. We're in the Great Southwest.
Just thanks. I'm sorry?
Yeah, go ahead. Give thanks. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, I just give thanks for being alive and being free and having the opportunity and all the blessings that I have and, you know, that many of us have and this opportunity to be here.
Yeah.
It's a blessing that I want to take for granted for sure. You know, and the opportunity for the freedoms that we have, it's a You know, there's been some discussion going on in one of the forums online regarding the U.S. Constitution being divinely inspired. And, you know, I have to agree with that. You know, the three branches of government, which, you know, is expressive up through the universe administrations, the sovereignty of the individual, the free will choice, you know, the ability for individuals to... to be honored to make their own choices and decisions in life. It's an interesting topic to have, you know, you have going on, you know, talking about the racial issues a little while ago also. And I find that very interesting. A more racially pure society is usually more cohesive and even stable. You know, where you have haphazard racial mixing, you know, you seem to have infighting and, you know, more competition amongst the races. It just seems to be an inherent thing. But anyway, I'll break for a minute and get some feedback.
Well, I appreciate that, and I throw it out to Crystalline and to David. You know, I personally believe that the Constitution was inspired. However, I don't think that the men who wrote it
lived up to it necessarily. Because we know that many of them were slaveholders, and we also know that many of them worked diligently to free slaves. And what we just read is that, you know, you can't maintain the ideals of statehood if someone is to be enslaved. And we must work diligently to lift all of humanity up to a level of dignity and equality, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, to realize that all men truly are equal before their creator. They're not equally endowed physically. We know that. Some people are smarter. Some people are, more agile. Some people can do the heavy lifting, and others can do the heavy thinking. And you need all of the above to function, mm-hmm. well. But all are created equally, in other words, loved equally by their creator.
Okay, and, well, what do you do when you have a group of people that believe themselves to be better and special and even chosen by God to rule the planet? Mm-hmm. And they're very intelligent, they're very creative, they're very, personable as far as ability to relate to others, and just have these very high qualities that you would want in human beings, but they use it for self-aggrandizement, exaltation, even to the point that they see themselves, as I said, you know, the chosen people, and everyone else is lower than them, and therefore animals and expendable, and can be used, enslaved, and taken advantage of, and
I would say they don't know God.
The word Jewish is sort of a taboo, you know, these days. Nobody wants to say. But it's that particular segment of society, at least certain ones within the Jewish community, that believe this. Not all of them, I'm sure. You know, but there is a segment of the Jewish community that do believe that. In fact, you know, they were active at the time of Jesus, and he dealt with that issue himself. And he called them out there at the end. He was very outspoken.
I don't think he was dealing with a racist, really, it per se. I think he was dealing with a mindset, and I think the mindset is exactly what you described, and I think that mindset can exist in any race and in any group of human beings where one person takes advantage of the other and entrenches themselves behind political power or ecclesiastical power or financial power. And mm-hmm. so I don't think it has to do with any one race of human beings. I think it's a human condition that,
well, and I think the way the Urantia book talks about race isn't necessarily the way we use it to describe just a
culture,
a particular racial group. But I think they're talking more about sort of a collective,
they're coming from the genetic perspective as far
exactly.
as the Sangiks.
Exactly.
No, the genetic,
I think they're
entity.
Talking more about genetics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there is a group, though, that seems to think that they are more special than all the other special people. You know, sure, there are lots of smaller groups scattered throughout the planet who think that they may be chosen and this and that and special.
Well, I think most of them
else.
Do, frankly.
Yeah, but you look at the ones that has the power today, I guess is what I'm getting at, as
mm-hmm.
far as moving into the positions of financial control of the money systems across
right.
the planet. You control the money, you control the people, you control the flow of resources and everything.
And here it comes the rule of law. And our right to enforce those laws as, you know, what he said, government by the people, for the people, and of the people, and to stand together against tyranny, no matter where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's what I believe in.
And we no
boycott.
Longer limit tyranny to any particular group.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're moving more and more all the time, almost globally, towards plutocracy, where it's the wealthy in whatever racial or religious group or political group that they're the super wealthy seem to have more power in almost every area.
Yeah, they lust for it, it seems. Yeah.
They what?
Now, once you got, I just posted they lust for it. I posted that in the chat room a minute ago. You know, once a person gets a taste of wealth, becomes addictive, it becomes an obsession, and, you know, the more luxuries they have, you know, the more luxuries they may want, because the temptations of the senses is very powerful in the here and now, you know, in this particular animal existence right now. And as you know,
we're also told in the paper that we just read that, you know, in section 6 it says, you know, that present day profit motivated economics is doomed unless profit motives can be augmented by service motives. Ruthless competition based on narrow-minded self-interest is ultimately destructive of even those things which it seeks to maintain.
Right, and that goes back to what David was saying, and that is within, and this, excuse me, David, I'm interpreting for you, but for me, what you said is something the Urantia book says very clearly, and that is within every evil deed is planted the seed of its own destruction.
Right.
If it's not of God, it will not stand. We can pretend that it will all we want, and we can build up the kingdoms of earth under our great dynasties of wealth and power, but if it is not of God, it will not stand. And this is something the Urantia book says unequivocally, and this is what causes civilizations to fall. It's because they lose their way and they become not of God. They're not based on righteousness and they're not based on reality. And because they're not real, they have no fundamental foundation to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and that's it. Within every evil deed is planted the seed of its own destruction. And
but we also have a lot of reassurance, too, that the way we learn in this universe is by trial and error, through experience, and through the experience of learning from our mistakes. So, you know, even people who may
be... keep making the same mistakes over and over, you know, as far as societies go.
Right. And well, you know, hopefully we do learn...
Yeah, there's an archaeologist named Ronald Wright that wrote a series of books regarding civilizations and progress. And he talked about the beginning with the progress of early man, you know, inventing an atlatl, which gave him a great advantage. And with that advantage, he hunted out and killed off all of his animal sources, the mammoths and many of the other animals, just killed them all out, you know, to the point that they didn't have a food source. And he said from that point, you know, we've seen progress go from civilization to civilization, and each one of them overtaxes its environment with its technology and falls because the populations grow too large and the food supplies, because of the technology, gets too small. And, you know, as far as farming, you see destroying the minerals in the soil to the point the soil is dead, can't produce anything. And now it's gotten to the point that's global. You know, it began very small and then, you know, became larger in countries across the Middle East. And now it's finally global and we're doing the same thing.
For the first time, though, in history, mankind is sort of recognizing that this might be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not universally everyone's recognizing it, but, you know, for the most part, it's something that's starting to be taken seriously. But I'm afraid we're at the end of the program.
Can you believe it?
I know. We have rapidly come to the end of another show.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for letting me call in.
Well, Jim, thank you for calling, and call back in, too. And you, too, David, thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you guys.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. And let's...
I'm for one short thing?
Yes.
Okay. Did anybody ever read that Games People Play book back in the 60s?
No.
Okay. His theory is the basis of all gamey behavior is mine is better than yours. But we get past that and we get into truth. It doesn't matter the race. It doesn't matter the history. It doesn't matter the religion. I personally had to let go of everything I ever believed in order to get into what I'm doing now in the light of new revelation.
Beautiful.
Gotta let it go.
That's surrender. Yep.
You bet.
Well, on that note, thanks, David, and thanks all of our listeners, and we hope you'll join us again next week, and maybe we'll get on this topic again in the not-too-distant future.
Right. We'll be on the other side of the election.
But until then, bye for now.
Bye for now. God bless.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.